Hello, everybody. Rafe's back this week, but he's not here just yet. And that means, as I'm the first person here, I get to host again. Right then, it is All About Symbian. It's the Insight Podcast. It's show number 128, which is an auspicious number if you believe in the power of two. And the two people who are joining me to power through this podcast are is the aforementioned Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody.
Are you sure you know what you're doing this week, Rafe?
Well, I do know what I'm doing, but whether it's a good thing is a completely different question.
Oh, there we go. We also have David Gilson.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, David. Hello, Rafe. We do not have Steve Litchfield this week. Steve is currently doing this at the Farnborough Air Show. Last week and the week before that, Rafe got to go to Silverstone. Next week, I get to go and see a little comedy poetry recital from Josie Long. Aren't I excited? David, anything exciting lined up for you in the future?
Oh, I think not. I'll be here every week, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's a bit of a grind, isn't it? Anyway, shall we get on with the news? Let's see. No more Dreamliners, no more Farmer, no more selling. Let's go with something new, though. The SDC, nothing to do with the San Diego Chargers football team. It's the Symbian Developer Cooperative. Rafe, this sounds very 1950s.
Well, it may sound a bit 1950s, but it's very much in keeping with the modern move to openness in the mobile space. So what SDC stands for is, in fact, Symbian Developer Cooperative. This is a non-profit organisation that's been set up to try and put individuals at the heart of the Symbian Foundation. Effectively, what it is, as the name suggests, a cooperative of developers, but you don't have to be a developer. It's anyone with an interest in the Symbian platform can join, who will then seek to influence the direction of the Symbian Foundation by taking part in the sort of the governance and the process involved in the Symbian Foundation. Now, the way this works is that the Symbian Foundation, as we know, in governance is set up with various councils for dealing with things like releases, road mapping, UI, and other aspects. Also, of course, the Symbian Board of Directors, you can become a package owner. But in order for any of that to happen, you actually need to be a member of the Symbian Foundation. Now, this is open to companies, but what the Symbian Developer Cooperative does is opens this up to individuals as well, because you can join the Symbian Developer Cooperative, who are a member of the Symbian Foundation, and thereby through them take part in all the governance and the various bits and pieces involved in the Symbian Foundation. It's also designed to give sort of individual developers and that kind of dimension of the community a direct say in the running of the foundation. Clearly, it's early days yet, but there are already over 100 associate members, and clearly there's quite strong interest for people wanting to get involved. In practical terms, what this would mean is that they'll have a vote in terms of when there's member meetings in the Symbian Foundation, a vote is required. It also means that they could be nominated to something like the Release Council, for example, or the Roadmap Council, which decides sort of the evolution of the future of the platform. I think this is pretty remarkable in some ways, because this is unprecedented as far as mobile platforms are concerned in terms of individual. It could be a one-man band developer could get involved through this and get right into the, say, the heart of the Symbian Foundation. If you compare sort of the governance of the Symbian Foundation to any other, it's already open, and this just makes it in one sense even more open to absolutely anyone at all, as well as being, you know, stakeholder companies. This is truly individuals as well. Now, compare that to something like Android, which is very much controlled by Google through Google employees, you know, controlling the source code and being gatekeepers, if you like. And of course, if you look at some of the other platforms like, you know, iOS, that's controlled by Apple, or Windows Mobile, very much controlled by Microsoft. And even if you look at some of the other Linux platforms like Limo, for example, they're very much controlled by their sort of member companies. And so I think how much of an impact this really has in the longer term is difficult to say. But I think, you know, when you talk about openness, the Symbian Foundation certainly has the leading credentials in this particular governance area. And I'm a firm believer in that kind of cooperative approach will pay dividends in the longer term, even if the immediate benefits aren't quite apparent to the consumer, for example.
I mean, it's an interesting contrast because a lot of people are going to go, oh, but Android's open as well. This is just Symbian adding in management layers. But Android, and certainly in the 3.0 version of Android, it's going to come up. Only Google can authorize code changes in certain parts of that, and they don't get released to even the handset manufacturers until just as they're shipping. Google keeps very, very tight control over the Android OS, and that is, Symbian Foundation, have a control, but that's because everybody's involved in the foundation. Nokia, for example, can't block out parts of Symbian 3 or Symbian 4 until their phone comes out, can they?
That's right. I mean, the Symbian Foundation openness, clearly Nokia is de facto in charge because it's making the most contributions and has the most people, developers, contributing to the platform. And I don't see that changing in the immediate future. I mean, there are package owners coming in from the outside, notably in things like image editing and video editing in video telephony, for example, and that's increasing all the time. But yes, there is a sharp contrast. Android is widely perceived as open. And, in the sense that it's open source, yes, that's true. But in terms of contributing to the platform itself, if you talk to various manufacturers, you'll find some of them have even attempted to make contributions. They've just been rejected, and then Google has done their own way of doing things, and that's, I think, quite typical of Google. It's not necessarily a bad thing, of course, because it does mean there's quite tight control and a vision, but if you look at, say, the road mapping aspects of Android, the details of 3.0 are only just coming out, and they're sketchy at best, given that this is a release that's due, I think, in the second half of this year. Compare that to Symbian 4, which is sort of due out in January, and we've really known about the sort of details of that since the beginning of the year, and we're now starting to talk about Symbian 5 and Symbian 6. And so the openness in that respect, there's a big contrast there. And as you say, in terms of actually checking in code changes, there's a big contrast to be drawn. As I say, Google employees typically act as the gatekeepers there, and therefore it's, to a certain extent, it's Google's way or the highway. And that's also reflected in some of the with Google strings that are talked about frequently with regard to devices and services. As I say, I wouldn't like to say that's a good or a bad thing, although I think there'll be plenty of people and open source advocates which will favour the open source way of doing things and that open governance as a sort of a process. And I do believe going forward that is going to be a benefit rather than a negative. But I don't want to say this is the best way of doing things at the moment, because clearly there are advantages and disadvantages on both sides.
Yep. How about we just say it's a different way of doing it?
Absolutely.
Right then. Okay. People always talk about app infrastructures, and one of the great application, Track and Protect, Ray, if I know you were looking at as well, this is something that enterprise people are going to absolutely lap up, but it's not going to get an inch of column space in any of the big consumer blogs, is it?
I don't know, actually, because, this is what's typically enterprise application. What it does, it's remote management. In other words, you can send a command to your phone and wipe it or lock it. That's typical of enterprise security applications. But, Track and Protect is actually aimed at the consumer rather than the enterprise user. There are quite a lot of enterprise solutions out there. They're typically integrated with something like Exchange or other services. For example, in the case of the Nokia devices, they're now in all of sort of Microsoft's enterprise products in terms of being able to lock them remotely and wipe them remotely. And what Track and Protect is really aimed at is the consumer who loses their phone or has it stolen and wants to get it back. And in addition to the kind of the wipe and the lock commands, which deals with the security side of things as far as companies are concerned, for the individual, probably, yes, there's concern about the sensitivity of your data, but it's really about wanting to get the phone back as soon as possible because it's a valuable piece of equipment and it's got your SIM card in it and all your personal bits of data, which may or may not be replaceable. So as I say, this is aimed at the consumer. What extra features does it have? Well, in addition to the usual remote commands, it's also got things like get location, which means you can track where your phone is, get a picture either from the front or the rear camera, actually get your phone to call you back, and various other aspects. The full details are in the review, but I think the best proof point I can give this is that I actually lost my phone when I was out at the British Grand Prix, and I used Track and Protect to get it back. And without Track and Protect, I wouldn't have got it back. And in this particular case, it was a picture from the front camera that enabled me to work out where I'd left it or where I'd lost it. And so that saved me, £300 worth of phone from going missing. And to be honest, I think it would have been unlikely that I'd have got it back. It does also, have the sort of reward screens typical of lock applications, if you return this phone. And what really is the hallmark of Track and Protect, why I refer to it as the Rolls-Royce version of remote management in the review, is it's been well thought out. So when you have the remote lock screen, for example, you lock your phone, but it will display owner information and a reward. But more than that, it will still allow you to call three numbers, you know, your home, your work, and a friend's number. Those are specified in the application setting. So someone can pick up the phone, and if they're kind of an innocent party, they're actually able to call you and arrange to get the phone back. Normally, that isn't the case. You know, it's just lock down everything on the phone as soon as possible. And it's very user-friendly. It's very easy to use. The website side of thing is, you know, designed to be as easy to use as possible. So for me, I would say if anyone hasn't got this installed, I would recommend having a very close look at it and consider installing it. In terms of the actual cost, it's a free piece of software, and you pay a sort of a unit price for every command you send. And I think it's €5 for something like 15 credits, and you can pay €10 and get sort of 25 credits. It then charges 2 credits a month, so I would say go for the €10 one, and that should last you, 18 months. Plus, if you lose the phone, you'll have to send maybe 5-6 commands, depending on your situation. But for significantly increasing the chance of getting your phone back if it's lost or stolen, you know, that's a bargain bit of insurance as far as I'm concerned, and certainly comes highly recommended from me.
There we go. Speaking of phones that are being found, the Nokia C6 is starting to pop up in small numbers around the internet and around the world. David, you're waiting eagerly for this, aren't you? This is quite a smart device in the mid-range for Nokia again, isn't it?
Yes, this is a phone I'm really looking forward to testing. It really ties in with Nokia's touted plan of democratizing smartphones, because a lot of people might write this one off as a poor man's N97 mini. Well, that's not a bad thing. If anyone isn't familiar with the C6, apart from going looking at all the videos on the internet, it's just to recap, it's a 3.2-inch resistive touchscreen, side-sliding screen with a QWERTY keyboard, a hardware keyboard.
Or in other words, it's a 5800 cut in half with a sliding keyboard and an upgrade on the camera and some of the other bits and pieces with the N97's widgets on the home screen, I believe. Is that right, David?
Yes, and you could even describe it as a love child of a 5800 and 5730.
you could, but we won't. This is a family podcast, believe it or not.
Okay, moving
most
on.
Most of the time, anyway.
Well, yeah.
The news this week was that it appeared on Nokia's UK store at a surprisingly high price of £289. We were expecting it to be lower based on the press release in April. Although it's also supposed to be coming out on Vodafone pay-as-you-go for £230 as well. So it's going to be available to buy soon, folks. And we are going to get a review unit soon, aren't we? And we'll be giving it an in-depth review and telling everyone what we think.
And you can pick it up from some of the other retailers, like Play for £250. I think, as is typical, you know, the phones tend to have a slight premium just around the launch period, and that drops after, you know, 3 or 4 weeks towards the sort of expected price levels. And then, you know, there's a subsequent decline to 6 months later. And I wouldn't be at all surprised, as just as happened to the sort of 5800 and some of the other devices sort of in this ballpark price area, it will drop to below 200 by, you know, say Christmas period or just after Christmas. And for what you're getting in terms of what's inside, you know, the Wi-Fi, the GPS, it's quite decent 5-megapixel camera, and the form factor with the keyboard, that hybrid approach, both touchscreen and QWERTY keyboard, I think there's going to be little to touch it in terms of, you know, similarly priced devices around, maybe some of the Android devices, but say getting that hybrid with some of the extras is, you know, quite unusual at that price point. So I think it be quite popular, sort of an alternative to some of the higher end Symbian 3 devices that will no doubt be on the market later this year, including of course the upcoming N8.
I suppose the only question that I have, and certainly in the mid-range, is that there's so little difference between these phones now that, you know, it's obvious that they're slotting into a place in a chain and in a suite of hardware, but it is addressing smaller and smaller percentages of the market there. You know, the C6 is very close to 5800. It's very close to the N97 Mini. It's very close to the other ones. It's very close to some of the other ones. Can all of these devices live together safely and happily, Rafe?
Well, this is a direct question on Nokia's segmentation strategy that has, you know, what they've used to dominate the phone market for the last decade. you know, is cut down the market into smaller and smaller slices and have a device address each of them. You know, and it's been very successful. It's basically what caused them to be as successful as they did over the last decade. Now, does that still fit in the age of when you have, you know, single manufacturers producing just one product, you know, like the iPhone, or, you know, maybe like Palm that just has a couple of devices to sort of fit into the different things? And I think the answer is yes, they're particularly in the mid-tier. I think what you have to understand is there's still quite a lot of variation globally in terms of what people like. You know, QWERTY devices are more popular in some countries than others, and some prefer, you know, the traditional phone style. And I certainly think there's still space for a certain amount of variety, but I would expect, and I would think it would probably be a good thing if Nokia maybe cut down on having quite so many device models. You know, it was, you know, 40 in the last few years, 40 or so per year, and I think that might drop to maybe nearer 30. It's, you know, difficult to say. Looking at the patterns for this year, it does seem to be it's going to be around the 30 mark, but it really depends on how you define some of the variants that we're getting, and especially now the, you know, you're getting the C1, the C11, the C12, and the C13.
Bingo.
And the same is going to happen in the, sort of some of the higher indexes. We've already seen that with the two different versions of the X5, for example. So yes, I think it is still a strategy that's correct. As I say, there is variation in each of those markets, and I think what's important to understand is when a consumer walks into a shop, they're not going to see every single Nokia device in their current portfolio in the shop at the same time. The operators are going to choose which one is best for their market or best fit into their own portfolio, and therefore, you know, there will not be that sort of overwhelming dominance of choice. But sometimes there is an argument to be made, wouldn't it be better to cut it down and just have one or two devices, so that, you know, people are maybe encouraged to go to the higher specified devices because, you know, they say they want a Nokia. They're, oh, right, I'll have to get that one then. And that's clearly what Apple are thinking in some of their strategy, and perhaps why they haven't released sort of more cut-down model and instead relied on sort of giving a longer length to their older models, you know, the 3GS now being kind of the cheap iPhone, if you like. But I'm still a believer in choice being the best way, especially as we are seeing distinct groupings of phone form factors, if you like. You know, you get the C5, the traditional mobile phone, you get something like the C6, you know, that's the hybrid device. You're getting the X6, which is, you know, the touch tablet, if you like. Similarly with the N8, and no doubt we're going to see more things like the N97 mini, sort of innovations around that. And then, of course, you have the E72 for the typical QWERTY, you know, style that's been innovated by BlackBerry so much over the last decade. So I think there is still a lot of room for different models, and I think it tends to be the tech media that sort of focuses on just having an interest in, you know, what has been dominant in the last maybe year to 2 years, which has been that kind of slate form, touch form factor. And a lot of that's to do with the iPhone and also the popularity of some of the initial Android devices. But I do think there's plenty of room for innovation outside of that, particularly from a cost point of view. You know, cost is still the single most important factor when you're buying a phone, and I think that tends to be ignored more than it should do, especially by kind of the high-end tech media.
Yeah, and there is always the case to be made that too much choice is disabling, although maybe just for geeks, but I mean, it's definitely they should carry on having overlapping form factors, because if you're researching into buying a phone enough, you'll always wish it you had certain features, but the one you're looking at doesn't quite have everything, and you think, oh, well, I wish I could have this crossed over with this. So I think definitely keep on doing the crossover form factors, please.
There we go then. Nokia are also powering on with some brand new innovative stuff, cutting edge things. The conspiracy for good. It's taken a while to actually work out what all of this is, but it's Nokia's 2010 version of the Nokia game, an actual reality game played in the real world, but on top of a fictional layer, which you can access through your Nokia phone. Rafe has been keeping a close eye on the action in central London with the evil corporations, murders, and that guy who does Lost as well, as I recall.
That's right. I'm only going to mention this briefly because it's still ongoing, but I would encourage people who are interested in this, what Nokia are calling a transmedia experiment, and it's sort of augmented reality gaming. It's actually done with Point and Find, the sort of special version of that, and it's all being orchestrated, the sort of storytelling element of it, by Tim Kring, who was the producers of the Heroes television series. There are
heroes, not lost. That was it. Yes. Oh, how gosh, what a mistake to make.
There are, of course, actions going on in London. The last weekend, as you're listening to this podcast, there's another one coming up next weekend, and there's one the weekend after that. So if you're in London and fancy getting involved, check out conspiracyforgood.com. Now, I went along last weekend as we're recording this podcast, and I had an enjoyable time sort of running around the South Bank of London, in between Southwark Cathedral, the Tate Gallery, and also the Monument on the North Bank, picking up these sort of clues from this augmented reality gaming and getting involved in the actual story, getting roughed up by some of the security guards from Blackwell Briggs. And I'm going to put a post on the site about this a bit later, describing it in more detail. But as an experiment in sort of storytelling and the way things are developing next, I think it's really interesting. So I would encourage people who have an interest in this kind of area, and maybe how the internet, television, websites, Twitter, etc., can cross over and blend into telling a sort of a story that kind of, as Ewan suggests, mixes fiction with reality. It's an interesting form of entertainment going forward, and it's a very social exercise as well, which is somewhat unusual in sort of technology and game playing, which isn't always as social as it could be. So, interesting experiment. There'll be more on the podcast on it when we've gone through this a bit further, more on the site in due course. But in the meantime, check out conspiracyforgood.com.
Indeed. And the words Ruby Ruler Extra have nothing to do with the game. Okay, other stuff that's been going on for people to play around and mick around with is the HX7, not some strange rocket fuel from America, but the new firmware coming out for some very nice of the eye devices. And David's been taking a look at the HXs, haven't you, David?
Yes, Steve's been kind enough to send me his i8910, which I think if anything happens to it, he may kill me. It's the first time I've had a look at one of these phones, and I have to say, just to quickly go over the hardware, it's a brilliantly made phone, and it's my first capacitive touchscreen I've used, and I think this really does speed up the user interaction, so that's good. And the speakers are the best speakers I've ever heard on a phone, and with its screen size, I think this is probably the closest thing the Symbian world has to an iPod Touch, if we can mention them. Really, when you're using it, HX7 isn't any great departure from a latest version, 5th edition user experience on Sierra Nokia's, which is a good thing. The home screen modes seem to have been borrowed quite liberally from the Sony Ericsson phones, with one original, like, widgetized version. It's full kinetic scrolling everywhere, and there is actually a menu to configure how the kinetic scrolling works, although, yes, I know this has been done for power users, although even I looked at that and felt somewhat overwhelmed and thought, I'm not going near that, so... It's good to have. It's interesting to see, but I'm not going to go there. I have had some problems with unresponsive icons, but it's not actually a bug that I can reproduce reliably. So there's some stuff there. Not quite sure if it's a bug or not. The camera is an 8 megapixel camera, and The pictures on it are looking a little bit dull, but I think they're maybe a bit more close to life. And the changelog for HX7, it's in an interesting form of English, says the following. This time, camera saves really images and videos in day and yyy.mm.dd, which I'm assuming refers to file names. That doesn't work. It's still saving pictures as photo 6, photo 7, etc. So it's not good if you want to have a quick way of organizing your photos. Another interesting thing to comment on this is that I know this is for power users who are quite happy flashing firmware and what have you, but it is an interesting contrast when you're used to using Nokia's with all the other ecosystem. On this, there's no software updater application, and there's obviously no app store. So the only way to get applications updated is reflashing the firmware. So in a way, it's so isolated, it does actually feel like you're stepping back 2 or 3 years. And I think that does highlight the importance that the App Store environment has had on the smartphone experience.
While it's interesting from an academic point of view, and we should point out at this point, there are some legal questions about whether it's actually legal to do this or not. So you'll do this entirely at your own risk if you do want to go ahead. And we've mentioned this on the site before.
But and obviously, if you're doing changes on the hardware as well, if you get something wrong in the firmware or the bootloaders, you know, there's not going to be anybody to help you get your device back from the brick status that it could easily end up at. So, yeah, you know, buyer beware, and you will probably have a lot of hacker's remorse too.
Definitely.
Yeah, and obviously, there's quite an active community around this, and it is going on. It's sort of, if you like, it's cooked ROMs, but we've seen plenty of this kind of activity on Android and Windows Mobile as well. So I think it's interesting that it's arrived in the Symbian world in a very big way, and it's actually also just starting to happen on some Nokia device as well, which is interesting in itself. But I think what's interesting there, you were saying, David, that it's like stepping back a couple of years. So did it underline the importance of a kind of smooth out-of-the-box experience and with everything that works in terms of software updater and recent applications, and it's kind of the importance of services to go along with the kind of the basic application set?
Yes, definitely. I think if you're the type of user who doesn't even really think about applications and isn't going to be adding anything to it, it doesn't matter. But that, there's a time limit on that frame of mind. Applications and app stores extending the functionality of your phone is slowly creeping into the mainstream. Most people are already aware of it, and you're really going to miss it. It's just not as good an experience having to search around on a web browser to get to download and run an installation file. Most people, apart from the likes of us, aren't going
to
do that.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair here, this is really about extending the lifetime of the, you know, Samsung i9 10 phone that people have bought. I can't really see people buying the i9 10 just to get into this specific community, being able to play with their phone. And in that sense, I think for people who have bought the phone and have made a sort of £400-£500 investment, they're able to get a lot more life out of their phone.
And staying with the hardware and rebuilding firmwares and doing stuff yourself, I put up an interesting post at the tail end of last week about reference hardware. This was partly to do with Google's cancellation of the Nexus One, and we just stuck it out there for people to play around with. We weren't trying to go around the networks. But the one of the advantages the Nexus One has is that it got really good hardware into the hands of people who wanted to play with Android very early on in the process, and basically turned a lot of them into great big word of mouth merchants who passed the word around about how good Android was on this new device. And you know, the question I put was, well, should the Symbian Foundation be doing something like that? Rafe, of course, rightly pointed out we already have the Zoom 2, don't we, Rafe?
Yeah, that's right. This is a reference device. It's actually really a reference device for Texas Instruments and their OMAP chipset, and it's actually used to sort of run any number of operating systems, you know, be it Android or some of the more esoteric ones out there. But it is, in theory, the official Symbian 3 and Symbian 4 reference platform, and you can now get Symbian 3 running on the Zoom 2. But it's probably fair to say it's not the world's most attractive or usable device in terms of slipping it into your pocket, because it's based on kind of a reference hardware. It's rather bulky and a little bit ugly.
It's a bit like if Fisher-Price decided to do a BlackBerry, isn't it?
Yeah, that's probably a fair description.
Now, the question, of course, in my mind, though, is should the Symbian Foundation look at having a more public reference design, something that everybody can see, not just the hardware manufacturers? I mean, I know that the Foundation like to be in the second tier, you know, in the background, not creating a lot of noise, just quietly getting on with the job. And part of that, I suppose, is the huge number of Finns that started off and helping up because of Nokia's efforts and now with the code base. But would a reference hardware available for the public help Symbian's PR image? I mean, they could get out now and be talking about Symbian 3. People could be seeing Symbian 4. These people who, in that rarefied tech atmosphere, that have burned Symbian and not burned Android and iPhone.
Yeah, well, the first thing to point out here is that this probably isn't going to happen, because the Symbian Foundation, you know, doesn't really have this within its kind of chartered aims, if you like. And it's not really a device manufacturer. Well, it's definitely not a device manufacturer. It's more about controlling the release of the open source project. So this isn't something that's really within the auspices of the Symbian Foundation. You know, Google's a little bit unique in that respect and probably has a lot more funding to throw at the problem. But, you know, the question still remains, you know, ignoring sort of practical concern side about whether it would be doable or whether it's within the scope of the, you know, foundation's current activities, would it be a good idea? I certainly don't think it would hurt them at all to have something of a reference device out there that they could maybe give away at developer events, or sort of, you know, get exactly the hardware that they wanted on it, so they could show things off and maybe make it possible for people to upgrade, you know, from Symbian 3 to 4 to 5 and so on going forward. And I don't think it would hurt their public image. However, part of me goes, I think that's less necessary when you have a manufacturer the size of Nokia behind you, who are going to, after all, be producing devices that you could maybe adopt as one of your reference devices. And maybe that's something the foundation should consider going forward, or asking Nokia to, you know, provide one with open bootloaders, which is often the problem in this case, the bootloader being a bit of software that lets you change the software on your phone in a relatively easy manner. We've already seen in the Android world the difference between the original Droid and some of the later Droids from Motorola having open bootloaders versus closed bootloaders. And the advantage of the Nexus One was it had an open bootloader, and therefore you could put anything you liked on it. So, sorry, getting away from it a bit and getting a bit technical there. But yes, I think there's certainly something to be said for this idea of something that, you know, Symbian could hang their hat off in terms of devices and show off. But as with all of these things, it's sort of a question that's going to be answered, I guess, in the sort of 6 months to a year time frame, because, you know, the Symbian Foundation still are in this transition towards Symbian 3, and more particularly Symbian 4 and 5.
Although an interesting idea, if Nokia were to drop off a container load of unbranded N8s, it'd be interesting to see what the foundation could actually do, given a free rein with them.
Absolutely, you know, and there's been enormous amounts of positive developer momentum and attitude creating by the fact that, you know, Google will hold a developer event or Google I/O and give everybody there a Nexus One as a way to kind of bootstrap or, you know, kickstart people's interest in Android. And certainly when I was in Barcelona GSM, you know, there was this mad rumor going around that Google was giving away phones just for going along for a 3-hour developer session. But no, it was completely true. And of course, developer at that conference went along and picked up an Android phone.
And they did exactly the same at the Game Developer Conference in San Francisco in March that I was at. The only people that weren't allowed free Android devices were people who were there on a comp or a press pass. So thank you very much. But every developer who turned up at the Game Developer Conference in San Francisco walked away with a Nexus One, or one of the Motorola devices, or one of the Samsung devices, but all running Android. So yeah, there aren't a huge number of these Nexus Ones out there, but the people who have them are influencers. The people who are out there are people who make that first move, who actually do promote it. And that's what I was trying to get to, the idea that Symbian need a hardware reference, that they can do that. And the idea of some unbranded N8s, I do hope the people who are listening to this podcast, who are high up in these companies, I think that's a good idea, and Rafe agrees with me, and that doesn't happen very often. Pay attention.
I would say that maybe not quite so extreme as unbranded, but I do think it would be a good idea if there was written into the developer budget, and this really would need to come from Nokia rather than the Symbian Foundation, given its non-profit status, you know, doing developer events and not charging developers €550 to get into the developer summit, which is going alongside Nokia World this year, but actually saying, right, it's a free to attend event or a nominal registration fee to sort of filter out a certain amount of people and say, you know, and everyone who comes along will be walking away with a Nokia N8 or whatever phone it happens to be, or they'll be getting one in due course. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of initiative is going to be needed to kind of seize the interest back. And it's a shortcut to getting developer attention and making people pay attention and say, right, let's have a look at this. Actually, this Nokia stuff is really quite good. And yes, I should be getting involved in it. And there is a golden opportunity coming up with Symbian 3, and particularly, I would say, Symbian 4, and the move to Qt for both Symbian and MeeGo. And I think that needs to be exploited. And I would hope, you know, something like that would be done, rather than maybe spending some money on advertising. Take it away from the consumer budget if that's where it needs to come from consumer advertising. Mm-hmm. But relatively speaking, for, you know, maybe 10,000-20,000 phones, yes, it's a lot of money. I do appreciate it's not a small amount. But I think that's the kind of gesture that's going to be needed to get developers back on side in a quick way. You can't let it happen just organically, because that's going to take too long.
Indeed, and it's a very, very small percentage. I mean, if you look at the Nokia's Q2 figures and for 2010, which we'll come to in a second, 24 million devices, you're talking about the difference that 10,000 devices placed in the right hands could make. You will probably get back just as much PR coverage from the fact that you gave away the devices, but it will be in places of people who are influencing, people who can magnify that message. But rather than just hitting off a news campaign, rather than sponsoring the a rerun of a television series on Channel 4 on Saturday nights called Misfits and with a tiny square that says Ovi in the corner, you could use that much better. 10,000 out of 24 million, it's not a huge amount. But that 24 million is a huge amount, isn't it, Rafe? Which we'll come to now.
Yes, you're right, Ewan. That is a big number. As you say, it's from the Q2 results. The big headline numbers here were an operating profit of 295 million with net sales of 10.1 billion. The profits were significantly down, depending on the way you look at it. It's a 31% fall in profits or a 40% decrease in earnings per share. So, you know, that's clearly a big downward number. It's not entirely unexpected, as we discussed in an earlier podcast. Nokia did issue a warning earlier in July saying that they were predicting their margins to be down. So the actual cause of this is they're making less money for every phone they sell, and therefore the margins that they make are low, and I think it's gone down to about 9.5% as opposed to sort of the 15% it enjoyed in previous years and sort of 12% it's hovered around recently in the last year or so. And obviously this is a big problem for them in the sense that this is a major drop off. The only thing I'd point out here is Nokia's margins are still the healthiest in the industry if you discount Apple, for example, which is a bit of an exception to all the rules in mobile much of the time. But, you know, compare it to Samsung or Motorola or Sony Ericsson, and Nokia still have, you know, pretty positive margins. And given their sort of grim outlook and the way they've been pounded on for the last year, I don't think this is necessarily all doom and gloom and the end, as some people have suggested. And indeed, I think the language in terms of talking at the positive, the outlook is much better. Q3, I think, will be much the same as Q2, and that was suggested in the sort of earnings call by OPK. But looking forward to Q4 and 2010, you know, they were much more positive. Kind of the underlying cause, if you like, of all of this is a lack of performance in the high end of the market. You know, that's the N-series type devices, and they have dropped off significantly. They're now well below 5 million, whereas if you look back to sort of 2000, 2008, they were sort of around the 10 million a quarter mark. But, you know, what Nokia said in terms of going forward, they, you know, OPK said Nokia will make a comeback at the higher end of the market. We will be bringing a family of Symbian 3 devices, which will be in place for Q4. We aim to ship 50 million Symbian 3 devices, and that's during the lifetime of the Symbian 3 product. So if you think a typical Nokia smartphone has a product life cycle of maybe 24 months, so, you know, it's going to be spread over 2 years, and clearly that will be alongside Symbian 1 initially and alongside Symbian 4 and Symbian 5 subsequently. You know, he talked about Symbian's position in terms of Nokia's software strategy and how there was going to be the same software in terms of Symbian 3 across all the products, so it'll be easier for developers to target it rather than seeing one version for N-series, one version for E-series, etc. And he said Symbian is about leveraging scale and covering a broad market footprint. MeeGo, by contrast, was about leveraging the speed of innovation at the high end, and that it's about creating the devices beyond the smartphone. Again, all things we've talked about in the podcast, but, you know, to summarize the feeling, OPK said, you know, we're coming to the end of a painful product transition at the high end. The N8 will mark the beginning of our renewal, and going forward, I believe we will regain leadership in our industry. Now, coming from Nokia, that language is, you know, surprisingly upbeat and surprisingly, you know, aggressive in one sense. You know, normally they're quite conservative in their statements, so I think they really believe that the N8 is going to be the start of their revival, and they talked about how operators have looked at it very positively and they've had a positive response. But I also suspect it's a lot of the devices coming in the pipeline after the N8, other Symbian 3 devices, the MeeGo devices, and, you know, looking into 2011, the Symbian 4 devices. You know, there was discussion of the US market, and OPK said, you know, that's about MeeGo, but we also feel Symbian 3 has a role to play there. And, you know, he was asked again about whether Symbian and MeeGo are the best software products for Nokia, and he said, you know, Symbian and MeeGo are the best combination for the smartest devices. Our focus with Mego is for the highest end smartphone devices. Symbian is and will continue to be our core software platform. We will continue to have Symbian devices across our entire portfolio, both at the high end and the low end, including the strong possibility of N series devices. Trying to tackle too much with one platform has proved challenging in the past, as we've discussed on this podcast, but we will need to manage the dynamic here. It's about managing the roadmap. So, you know, that's very positive language around the software platforms. You know, a real hammer home of, you know, Nokia's announced software strategy. But to go back to what you were originally saying, Ewan, yes, 24 million is a lot of devices, and that's obviously primarily come from the mid-tier and lower-end smartphones, you know, like the 5230. But, you know, when people write Symbian offers dead or dying, it's rather ironic given that it's got, you know, very healthy increase in sales. It's growing at the same rate as the rest of the market. Indeed, you know, its Android has been the spectacular growth in 2010. That's definitely fair to say. But, you know, we've seen relatively flat growth from everybody else. You know, BlackBerry's also doing quite well. It's continuing to grow, but it's actually growing slower than the market average. So in one sense, Symbian's platform's growth is second only to Android this year. But of course, that's not a stat you'll hear talked about simply because of the poor performance at the high end, which I would, you know, underline is a very serious problem. But it does look like it is going to be addressed in the next 6 months. So while Q3, I think we can expect to see sort of further gloomy results, Q4 will be the start of, you know, the upside. And it's quite clear that Nokia really believe they can retake the market leadership.
I mean, David, I mean, you're not so immersed day to day with all the business mechanics and everything. What did you make of this announcement? Obviously, Nokia are going to try and put their best spin on it, and competitors are going to put their most negative spin on it. What was your big takeaway from the earnings and the results calls?
I just think it's a really interesting time because in spite of the constant PR bashing and the drop in profits, Nokia have managed to hold the ground with market share. Now, if market share translates at all into public awareness, which it must do because market share means the public owning the phones, I think it means that Nokia is still where they want to be to put in action all the strategies that they've been working on. And it is just so interesting watching the public reaction because, and it's clear that Nokia have been very patient. They have a long game in mind and they are just following it through, keeping the faith that it'll work out in spite of everything that's going on, which is good because it would be a shame if they just started acting reactively to things. And changing what they've been doing because that would be a lot of wasted time. The one thing I do hope they do change, and I hope an integral part of their strategy is that they speed up their release cycle because they need to get the hardware into people's hands.
Rafe, I'm gonna let's take some of those points, but I also want to be devil's advocate just for a moment. The elephant in the room is there are a number of sites that have been suggesting that Nokia are going to be changing their CEO, and those news has been magnified around the blogs and everything. Devil's advocate, let's say Nokia do change CEO. How much impact would that have on the Symbian Mego plans? I mean, you know, some sites would just go, oh, change CEO, get Android in, there you go. There's just no way that Nokia could do that, even with a new CEO, is there?
Yeah, well, leaving aside the fact that switching to Android just isn't going to happen because Nokia aren't going to be willing to concede that kind of initiative to Google because they can't. I mean, Google is Nokia's biggest competitor now, no one else.
Yeah. Nokia believe they're in the software and services space, which is the same space as Google, so why would you change the front door?
Absolutely. And quite apart from whether it's even, you know, a good idea from a, you know, technical and strategic point of view, you know, from a business point of view, it just can't happen. But even if a CEO came in with that, which again wouldn't happen, no, you can't change a strategy like that overnight, even if you wanted to. And indeed, the CEO, while he may sign off on the strategy, probably isn't the person that, you know, directs it. Nokia having a strategy division and executives in charge of looking at this kind of thing. So, you know, that just isn't going to happen. And I think, you know, this changing a CEO would really be about keeping the markets happy, keeping the shareholders happy. And, you know, Nokia's unfortunate thing in one sense is that a lot of their shareholders are in the US and they look at the performance in their own market, don't see Nokia there and don't really understand what the grand plan of strategy is. I don't think anyone would deny that Nokia has had a lot of trouble executing and has performed poorly in the last few years, particularly the high end of the market. But nor should they be written off altogether. And there have been significant achievements. You know, looking at the penetration of smartphones into the lower end of the market has been very successful. They've managed to sort of, in one sense, come back in the mobile phone space. You know, when it looked like they would be swallowed completely by some of the Chinese manufacturers, there are signs this quarter that, you know, with increased sales, they're fighting that off quite effectively. And there is this broad software vision in place, a combination of Symbian, MeeGo, unified by Qt, which I think doesn't have the chance to have its come to fruition yet, but certainly will do. So I think the idea of changing CEO would be a balm maybe to the market. But in terms of where Nokia is going next, no, I don't really think it would change it, nor would it be practical to do so. So in that sense, I think, you know, the CEO question, they may be keeping their options open, but it may really be about if they find the right person, could it happen? Yes. But we may be looking at a very different situation in 6 months' time, at which point the market may be going, well, actually, no, OPK, you can stay in place. And I think it's just a question of which breaks first, you know, the market's patience or sort of Nokia's willingness to sort of just put up with the criticism.
The one takeaway I think that I had from all of that is that it's the choice between short and long term. And this ties in exactly with what you're saying of if Nokia are going to want to appease the markets or keep going. The earnings call is, again, Nokia have put a long term plan in place. I mean, we talked about this a good couple of months ago, that it, you know, Nokia will look like they're standing still, like Batman, and people will run away down the dark alley, and then all of a sudden they'll turn a corner and run smack into Batman, and they'll go like, I'm here, I'm Batman. You didn't move! How did you do that? It's because Batman had been planning that all along, and Nokia are planning to do something all along as well. It's just taking multiple years. Unfortunately, you've got to do these calls every quarter. You've got to give the numbers at every quarter. You're a publicly traded company, and people are looking for short-term profit in the markets. And so it's that short-term nature that puts all the pressure on a long-term plan. Long-term plans are actually much harder to do in business than reactive, but it's the long-term plans that allow you to change from being a rubber tire company to ditching everything except your mobile phone, becoming a mobile phone company, then going to software and services. It's how long Nokia can appease the market. So if they look, we do have a long-term plan. And I suspect that it is going to come down to the results of the N8. OPK got dealt a really bad hand. He'd only been there like a handful of weeks, and then the iPhone turned up. And then, you know, as have been written in other websites, you know, everything changed. Apple handed a new rule book to all the American journalists, and they all followed it. So I think it will depend on the success of the N8. If that is a stellar device, if it takes off, OPK is okay. If it's not, then Nokia may have to go, look, we have to relieve some of this short-term pressure. And it's at that point you need a very honourable CEO to take the correct decision.
I think you may be being just a bit too kind to Nokia there. There's a contrast to what usually happens in this podcast. I think Nokia does have an execution problem. That's been at the root of its malaise for the last few years. Going forward, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the long-term strategy is in place in terms of Symbian, MeeGo, Qt as a kind of overall vision, and then Ovi being put on top of that. And Ovi certainly needs to improve, particularly in the execution. You know, look at maps. That's been done well, but other areas maybe not so much. And I think that that's where Nokia will be judged in the next 12 months. It's about execution. And clearly, with the reorganisation, there is the sort of structure in place to improve on that. Will it actually happen? You know, because we've had this before with Nokia. At the same time, of course, you know, Nokia is so big that it will keep rumbling on regardless. But the degree of its success in the next 12 to 24 months will depend on the speed of execution of the plans that are in place. And we are at a crossroads now where if Nokia doesn't do it with, you know, the N8 and subsequently Symbian 4 and the first couple of versions of MeeGo, then there will be a lot of question marks to be asked over its longer term future. I personally remain pretty optimistic because, you know, you look at it and you think, yes, that's the right way to do it. And I think Nokia have learned a lot of the mistakes that some of the current smartphone manufacturers, be it RIM, HTC, so Android, even to an extent Microsoft with Windows Mobile, have made once already. And it's sort of a dual approach on software, you know, one thing for the smartphones, another for the devices beyond smartphone, is very much ready to address what the market will be like in the next few years. But as I say, there is that execution question, and that will be the thing I will be looking at very closely in the time ahead.
So all it remains for me to say thank you all for listening, and also to thank my co-host, David Gilson.
Thank you very much, everyone. Bye.
And Rafe Blandford.
Thanks, everybody.
This is the brutally shortened ending to the All Bits Media Insight podcast number 128, because we've had so much to cover this week. Leave your comments at www.allaboutsimian.com. You'll find us in all the usual places, and we shall catch you back here next week. No matter what MP3 you're listening to, it's going to be a good one. Goodbye for now.